Those of you who are here this morning, I said we were going to start a study that I had mentioned several weeks ago that would be something we were going to look at during 2007. And that, of course, is the book of Ezekiel. Tonight we're going to, briefly anyway, look at Ezekiel chapter 1. And what an incredible book this is. What an incredible book this is. Filled with metaphors and allegories and strange symbols, visions of all kinds, figurative language, even apocalyptic literature. Some of the visions that Ezekiel have are so vivid, it's like you can almost see a painting right in front of you with great details. And throughout this book, and of course we won't have time to look at every verse of every chapter, we're going to look at some of the main lessons that we can get from this marvelous book. And I think we're all going to be better people because of it, because Ezekiel teaches some wonderful lessons. This book is important, and we certainly would never want to neglect it. Ezekiel was born during the reign of good King Josiah. Josiah, you will remember, was sometimes called the boy king. He became a king when he was only 8. Started ruling over the southern kingdom of Judah. So it was during his reign that Ezekiel is born. Of course, Ezekiel is born in that southern kingdom as well. So that's the time frame we're looking at. Josiah was the last good king of Judah. Because when Josiah dies, there are 4 kings that come after him, all of whom were very evil, very wicked kings. Those kings, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and of course, lastly, Zedekiah. When Ezekiel's about 16 or 17 years old, Jehoiakim is the king. And this is when King Nebuchadnezzar first launches his invasion of Judah. And it's during this first reign, this first invasion, that Daniel is taken, the king is taken, the royal descendants are taken, nobles are taken back to Babylon. So Ezekiel stays in Jerusalem. He's not taken. Ezekiel was not in any sort of royal line. He wasn't a noble, wasn't in one of those royal descendants. So he doesn't go in that first round of captives back to Babylon. He stays there. He's only 16 or 17, but he sees Daniel and the king and others being taken back to Babylon. And so about 8 or 9 years later, then King Nebuchadnezzar comes back, launches another invasion, another battle against Jerusalem. This time, Ezekiel's about 25 years old. Jehoiakim is the king, the next to the last one. And what happens? King Nebuchadnezzar takes about 10,000 captives from Jerusalem, including Ezekiel. Now, Daniel's already in Babylon as a captive. Of course, he goes back to the royal court and he prophesies to those in the main city of Babylon, the city of Babylon. And he's been there for 8 or 9 years. Ezekiel is still back in Jerusalem. Now Ezekiel is taken with these 10,000 other captives. They're taken back to Babylon. They're not taken to the capital city, though. They're taken into the countryside, and we see that Ezekiel ends up in a kind of a small area, a small town, a small village called Tel Abib. By the way, this is the name from which modern Tel Aviv gets their name. So it comes from Babylon. So that's where Ezekiel ends up. Small village. He's about 50 miles from Babylon. Daniel's in the capital city, been there for 8 or 9 years. Now, Ezekiel is taken captive, but he doesn't go there. He goes with these other captives to this small town, not too far from Babylon. And he ends up by the river Kebar. The river Kebar is not like the rivers we have around here. It was a canal, basically, that had water that connected parts of the Euphrates River. So that's where Ezekiel spends much of his time. He's taken captive and ends up there. Well, in 592, now we're to 592 B.C., Ezekiel is 30 years old. Ezekiel, of course, is a priest. And a priest, if you remember from the law of Moses, didn't start serving as a priest until they were 30. They served from the time they were 30 until the time they were 50. So they basically served as a priest for 20 years. That was their job span of their duties, lasted 20 years. So he begins his prophetic work when he's 30 years old. At that time, Nebuchadnezzar had not came and destroyed the city of Jerusalem, had not destroyed the temple. They were still standing. And so the people, the ones that had been taken captive back to Babylon, were still somewhat optimistic. And there were some false prophets that arose and said, hey, we're going to be going back to Jerusalem really soon. 592 B.C. 5 years later, of course, the story's very different. Nebuchadnezzar and his forces come in, the Babylonian forces and the army, and wipes out the city of Jerusalem. Tears down the wall, tears down the city, destroys the temple. And so about this time, Ezekiel's about 35 years old, had started his work, been doing it for about 5 years. Another sad event, though, happens during this time period. During that siege of Jerusalem in 587 B.C., Ezekiel's wife dies. She's killed by Nebuchadnezzar's forces when they enter that city and destroy the city of Jerusalem and destroy the temple. During this same time period, Jeremiah is prophesying. But Jeremiah is not taken captive anywhere. He's left in Jerusalem with the poorest of the people. So during this time, we have Daniel in the capital city of Babylon prophesying to those people. And of course, we go back to Daniel chapter 1 and find out some of what's happening there. Ezekiel is outside, kind of in the rural land by this river Kibar, with several thousand captives. Kind of the middle class, sort of. And then we have Jeremiah left in Jerusalem with the poorest of the people, and that's where Jeremiah prophesies. Daniel's in the capital city, Ezekiel out in the countryside of Babylon, Jeremiah, we might say, back home. They all have very similar messages, though. Very similar messages. Daniel's messages and Ezekiel's messages come in some very unique visions, whereas Jeremiah's is not. Jeremiah is very plain and straightforward in his message, in really every sense of that word. Ezekiel continues to prophesy until he's about 52 years old. And then his prophetic work ends, which puts his work stopping about halfway through that 70 years of captivity. His message is threefold primarily, and you see this throughout the entire book. Number one, his first and primary duty at the beginning was to convince the people who had been taken captive that they were there for one reason and one reason only, because they had disobeyed God. In other words, their captivity was a direct result of them rebelling against God. And he couldn't go further with his message until the people understood that fundamental concept, that fundamental reason why they were there. Number two was a message of hope for the people there, for the captives, that God was going to bring at least some of them back home. And then the last part of his message was that a brighter day was coming when the Messiah was going to come and set up his kingdom. And as we look at the book of Ezekiel the next several Sunday evenings, we're going to be seeing that threefold message. Let's begin the book, Ezekiel chapter 1. Notice, first of all, the first three verses, which introduces us to the prophecies that he's going to be seeing, the vision. Now, it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. The heavens were opened, and he saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, which was in the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. Now, beginning in verse 4, he sees four scenes. It's one vision, but four scenes, all revealing God's glory. Now, he's getting ready to start a long prophetic work that went on for many years. But he begins this prophecy like a lot of prophetic books, in that he begins by describing who God is. That's what his first vision is all about. Who is God? What's his character? What's his nature? What's he like? And that's what he does in these next four scenes, beginning in verse 4. It says, "Then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire." Usually a whirlwind in the Old Testament prophetic books almost exclusively was talking about a judgment of some sort. What does he see? He sees a great cloud. There's raging fire engulfing itself. In the Hebrew, this means we've seen dark thunder clouds, and we see lightning within the cloud going all around it. That's what the Hebrew word here signifies. It's like a great cloud with lightning shooting everywhere inside of it. I tell you what, this would have got his attention, and maybe that was the purpose. "Also from within it came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces, and each one had four wings. Their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze." Here we have now, we start the prophecy, we start these visions with some pretty extraordinary looking creatures. He said each one of these four living creatures had four faces, but they were all alike. These four living creatures, they were alike. And each of them had four wings. Verse 8, "The hands of a man were under their wings on their four sides, and each of the four had faces and wings." The hands of a man were under their wings. So we see a creature that had four faces. Under these wings were hands right underneath them. So we see wings and hands. That's what he's seeing, and that's what he's describing to us. He goes on, "Their wings touched one another. The creatures did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces," here are the four sides of the four faces that each creature had. "Had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side. And each of the four had the face of an eagle." So there were the four faces. Man was on one side, lion on the other, on another, the ox, and the eagle. And of course, when we look at the Old Testament, those were all significant in many ways. We know why, or we know how significant, or what significance the man would have, but what about these three animals? Because those three animals were quite different. The lion, of course, was the king of the jungle, the king of the wild beasts, right? Lions were not domesticated like oxen, so they were wild animals, but very strong, very brave, very courageous, very bold. And then, of course, we see the ox. Ox would certainly represent those domesticated animals, and they had domesticated animals back then just like we do today. The ox was known, of course, for its strength. And the eagle was the king of the birds. The king of the birds. could see. It was fast. Eagles, of course, are known for their exceptional farsightedness, being able to see far away. So when you think about all of those characteristics, and you think about those creatures that have them, the point we see that he's trying to make, he says he's seeing visions of God, God's glory. God has all of those characteristics, but to an infinite degree. He's infinitely strong, infinitely powerful, infinitely far-sighted. He is infinitely fast, infinitely bold. All of those characteristics God has to the greatest degrees. And so this creature, these four living creatures that have the wings and have the hands underneath them, are able to carry out everything God wants them to do. God gives them the power to carry out whatever His bidding is. Notice verse 11. Thus were their faces, their wings stretched upward, two wings of each one touched one another, and two covered their bodies. And each one went straight forward. They went wherever the Spirit wanted to go, and they did not turn when they went. Notice, they went wherever the Spirit wanted to go. Wherever God directed them to go, and they were all in unison. You know, we think about four living creatures that have four faces, and they each have several wings, and they each have hands, but they're all acting together, all united. They're all doing whatever God tells them to do. They're at His bidding. Whatever the Spirit tells them to do, they are going to do it because God is controlling them. God is behind all of this. So He's just getting them started. Remember this prophecy here at the beginning is about showing who God is, and that's what Ezekiel is doing. He's getting people to understand who God is, His powers, His qualities, His characteristics. And He's showing it in a very vivid, unforgettable way. So we see His majesty and His supremacy. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning, and the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. Scene 1 ends of this first vision. Scene 2 begins, verses 15 through 21. Now I looked at the living creatures. Now as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each living creature with its four faces. So he's revealing more. He's revealed something in the first scene about God and about His character and qualities and characteristics. Now he's seeing more. Now he says, beside each of the faces is a wheel. The appearance of the wheels and their workings was like the color of beryl, and all four had the same likeness. The appearance of their workings was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. And in the Hebrew language, this suggests that you have a wheel that's like this way, and then you have another wheel that bisects it, goes straight through it. Of course, we couldn't build anything like that. All right, this isn't something that's physical. He's not trying to say you need to go build a wheel like this. This is a vision about God and His glory and His majesty. So we have a wheel that's bisected by another wheel. So we have what? Wheel going in all directions, and that's the whole point of this. He's pointing that out with these wheels. And he says, when they moved, they went toward any one of four directions. They did not turn aside when they went. As for their rims, that let me not even go to the rims yet. These wheels were able to go in any direction God wanted them to go. Again, suggesting God is not limited in any way. Of course, God has always had messengers and servants. But God is not limited in any sense. He can see everything. He can be everywhere at once. He knows everything. Now remember, there were people who thought back when Ezekiel started prophesying that they were not going to be there very long. See, some prophets were saying, we're just going to be here a short time, and later we'll see that they said, you don't even have time to plant a garden or start a house. We're going to be going back to Jerusalem so fast. So Ezekiel is planting the seed here by saying, God is the only one that knows. God's all-seeing, all-knowing, all-present. And he emphasizes this when he says in verse 18, as for their rims, the outer part of those wheels, the whole outer part of the wheel, we might call the circumference of the wheel, they were so high, they were awesome, and the rims were full of eyes all around the four of them. So the wheels were filled, the rims completely with eyes. God is able to see everything. As prophets have said in the Old Testament, it doesn't make any difference where you go because God is there. And this is what Ezekiel is wanting to emphasize to the captives, that God's the only one that knows. Because God sees everything. God sees Jerusalem. God is seeing Babylon. He's seeing all the captives. He can see backward in time. He can see forward in time. He can see everywhere because He's everywhere present. And so Ezekiel is really driving home the point that God is the only one that knows. God is the all-knowing, all-seeing God. Regardless of what you may hear, God knows. When the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them, and when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Wherever the Spirit wanted to go, they went, because there the Spirit went. And the wheels were lifted together with them, for the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When those went, these went. When those stood, these stood. And when those were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up together with them, for the Spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. God does know all, and He sees everything, and He's everywhere present, all the time. Scene 3, verse 22. The likeness of the firmament. Now we've added something else. First of all, we saw the four living creatures, and then we saw the wheels that went with them, and now he adds the firmament. The likeness of the firmament above the heads of the living creatures were like the color of an awesome crystal stretched out over their heads. And under the firmament, their wings spread out straight, one toward another. Each one had two which covered one side, and each one had two which covered the other side of the body. When they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of many waters, like the voice of the Almighty, a tumult like the noise of an army. And when they stood still, they let down their wings. A voice came from above the firmament that was over their heads. Whenever they stood, they let down their wings. The pictures enhance. More details are seen in this painting, this vision. There's more there now. The four living creatures with their four faces, and we see their wings with the hands underneath them. And then we were introduced to the fact that each had these wheels within a wheel. And now, we see something else. These four living creatures are holding up the firmament. The firmament. That's what they're doing. It's part of their, we might say, job. Back in Exodus 24, way, way back in time, before Ezekiel. But in Exodus 24, notice how similar this is. Exodus 24, verses 9 and 10. I think it's 9 and 10. Exodus 24, verses 9 and 10. Then Moses went up, also Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. There we see God, God's throne. Underneath him is this, what Ezekiel calls, a firmament. And it was brilliant, according to Ezekiel. It was bright. like crystal. It said as it was stretched over their heads. Isaiah had a very similar prophecy years before Ezekiel prophesied. I remember Isaiah prophesied way back in the 700s B.C. So many, many, many years before Ezekiel. But Isaiah had a similar vision. Isaiah chapter 6, verse 1. Isaiah's prophecy was about the throne of God. Isaiah said, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up. High and lifted up. These creatures, which Ezekiel later calls cherubim in Ezekiel chapter 10, are holding up that they're ready to serve. And it says, when they moved, the noise was deafening. What's getting ready to happen? God's getting ready to say something. And so these four living creatures in this vision are trying to get the people through Ezekiel to say, listen to what's going to be said. God, who sits on this throne, is ready to speak. Which means they need to listen. Scene 4, the last one in this chapter. And above the firmament over their heads was the likeness of a throne in appearance like a sapphire stone. On the likeness of the throne was a likeness with the appearance of a man high above it. Remember Isaiah? I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high and lifted up. Also from the appearance of his waist and upward I saw as it were the color of amber with the appearance of fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his waist and downward I saw as it were the appearance of fire with brightness all around. Like the appearance of a rainbow in a cloud on a rainy day, so was the appearance of the brightness all around it. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. So when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard a voice of one speaking. This vision of Ezekiel has been building since verse 4. Each scene added something to the prior one. It's like watching an artist start with a picture and him just have part of the picture there. And so we see that part, and then we start to understand this part. And then he adds something to it. And then the artist adds more to the picture. Until we're finally, we see this whole picture, and we understand what the artist is trying to say, his point. That's what Ezekiel is doing here with the four scenes. Getting the people ready because the one sitting on the throne is getting ready to speak. And what a throne it is. It's brilliant, it's beautiful. There's no other throne like it anywhere. Because God's throne is the only throne. He's the one that rules the universe. No one else. There's no greater throne. And then we see the appearance, it says, like a rainbow. Now that seems to I guess if we were seeing a picture of what Ezekiel was drawing, it's like something that doesn't belong in the picture. I mean, we've seen these dazzling, brilliant stones in the firmament and the four living creatures, and we see that he's emphasizing power and majesty and knowledge. And then we see a rainbow. It seems so out of place in this vision. But what did a rainbow signify? And what would it have signified to these people who were captive? God's mercy. God said, I'm never going to destroy the earth again with water. And to make sure you constantly remember that I'll never destroy this earth by water, I'm going to put a rainbow in the sky to remind you that I will never do it. God's majesty and His mercy. They're not separate things. So many of the people in the world seem to think that those are separate, and you can't have a God that's majestic and powerful and all-knowing and yet have a God that's loving and merciful. That's the God that's getting ready to say something. That's the God that's getting ready to speak through Ezekiel, and this God has something to say. What has Ezekiel done? He's gotten people ready to hear God's message. That's what he's done. People do that today when somebody important is getting ready to say something. Maybe it's a national figure, maybe it's a king or a ruler of some nation. You know, there'll be all kinds of things done to get people ready to listen to him. And that's what Ezekiel's doing here. He's getting the people ready to hear the master of the universe, the ruler of the universe, the one and only God, because he has something important to say. And what he has to say is both a message of despair and a message of hope. Despair to all those people who refuse to listen, who continue to rebel and disobey, but a message of hope to all those people who are willing to listen. And that hasn't changed, has it? We need to respect what God says. Because God speaks from His throne right through here. That's what He's doing. God is speaking from His throne. And when God gets ready to say something, man needs to listen. Man needs to put everything else aside and listen to what God has to say. Because He's the one and only God that knows all and sees all and is everywhere present. So that message that was delivered almost 600 years before the time of Christ, and you know, almost 2,600 years ago now, is a message for us. The God of the universe, the only God, is ready to speak, and He wants us to listen. And that's our invitation as well. He wants us to listen. When God says that the only way to Him is through His Son Jesus, we need to listen to that. When His Word tells us that we have to experience the new birth, we need to listen. When He tells us that we need to continue to repent and confess our sins, we need to listen. Because it's Jehovah God. Tonight as we sing this invitation song, the opportunity is ours if we need to respond. Let's stand as we sing this song.